From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's hot. It's beach weather. It's sandal season. And people want to show off their pretty toes.
Well, I love getting rainbow toenails.
But what if your toenails look scary?
Oh my goodness. Honey, what happened to your toe?
On today's show, a look at a stubborn fungus that affects and embarrasses millions of Americans.
They're afraid to come to the doctor. I've had patients who've come here with nail fungus, and they want the door closed. They don't want anyone to see them. And I was like, oh, it's so much more common than you realize.
We'll hear about research, treatment, and why there are so many fake cures.
A patient came in with bright green toenails.
Also on the show, did Pennsylvania's Department of Health stifle conversations about the impact of drilling? And kids doing cancer research? Really? First, the news. I'm about to step into a really, really dangerous place. It's a nail salon. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott.
We see and deal with things that people shouldn't have to see and deal with daily.
I'm basically what they call a lab rat. If I wasn't a chemist, I'd be a cook. Chemistry's like cooking, but don't lick the spoon.
You know, the old days of sitting in a lecture for an hour or hour and a half, they are long gone.
I myself use cannabis to be well.
But if there's too much resistance there, the tissue will have increased friction. I'll give you an example of EAOU.
Scientists in clinical research.
Jellyfish genes and potatoes. Yeah.
Your brain is always changing. It's never the same from 1 minute to the next.
On today's show, too much salt in our food has public health officials all worked up. Not enough saline in our hospitals has healthcare providers all worked up. Also, a look at questionable Lyme disease tests and a potential fix for South Jersey veterans waiting for care. But first, let's head back into that nail salon. It's where we go to beautify our hands and our feet. But many experts say it's a breeding ground for an all-too-common but hard-to-cure affliction, toenail fungus.
They are keratin-loving species. That's what they go after.
Tracy Vlahovic is a Temple University podiatrist. Her specialty within that field is dermatology. So pretty much anything that makes the rest of us go, yuck.
I don't think it's yuck. I think it's fantastic. I love treating fungus and warts.
Toenail fungus is one of the main reasons people come to her office, and Vlahovic has studied the condition for years. Viewed through a microscope, her enemy appears rather meek.
They look like thin straws with little compartments in it.
But it's part of a mean and aggressive fungus family.
The fungus that affects the foot in general, they are called dermatophytes. They love hair, nails, and skin. So actually the same organisms that cause athlete's foot can cause nail fungus.
If it gets into the nail bed, the fungus eats and digests the keratin in the nail, and that causes discoloration and thickening of the nail, a cosmetic condition that can get pretty painful. People who have chronic athlete's foot are at risk for developing toenail fungus, and there seems to be a genetic predisposition. The fungus also lurks in shared showers, near pools, and...
patients have come in and said this all started after a pedicure. There is a great book called Death by Pedicure.
It's written by podiatrist Robert Spalding, who has been on a decade-long crusade to make nail salons safer.
They use contaminated instruments in some cases, or they don't take the time to properly disinfect and follow their state protocols.
Nail fungus and other microorganisms are really tough to kill, and Spalding says the only surefire way to sterilize the instruments is to use something called an autoclave.
An autoclave is basically a pressure cooker. It's steam under pressure for a specific period of time. It's how the instruments are cleaned for surgery.
The foot-soaking tubs are another cesspool of infection that Spalding says some salons are eliminating.
Now they're actually going to tubs that have liners. They don't use the jets as much. They'll use some types of vibration. And now they're coming up with more of what's called a dry pedicure, where they just take hot towels and soak the feet.
Spalding estimates that 75% of salons do not disinfect their instruments and tubs properly, and he has developed training seminars for nail care techs and offers both an app and a website where consumers can check if their salon is safe. Even though it's so easy to catch, toenail fungus embarrasses people. It's a hush-hush topic, and only a fraction of the estimated 55 million Americans who have the condition seek treatment in a doctor's office.
I'm part of this secret society of fungusy toenail sufferers that, you know, we can like band together and have meetings or something.
Liz is a Philadelphia mom in her 30s, and she doesn't want to use her full name for this interview.
It looks terrible if you don't maintain it. And you're just like, toenail fungus? That's the grossest thing. I told my husband I was going to talk to you. And he said, oh my God, you're going to have this reporter come over and talk about toe fungus?
It started about 10 years ago when Liz cracked her big toenail. After that, the nail started to look funny and became discolored. Then it spread.
Toe to toe to toe to toe.
When Liz realized she had nail fungus, she was faced with another unpleasant fact. It's really hard to treat. Podiatrist Tracy Vlahovic explains.
The toenails have the smallest blood vessels. They're the furthest away from your heart. It's going to take anywhere from 6 months to a year to even 2 years for some people for the nail to grow from cuticle to the tip of the nail.
For years, it's been slim pickings in terms of pharmaceuticals. There's a topical called Penlac that seems to work sometimes for very mild cases, and then there are pills that people have to take for several months. The oral medications are efficient, but many people are afraid of them because of potential side effects, such as an impact on liver and kidney function. Vlahovic admits the search for a cure has been a bit sluggish.
It's not something that necessarily people are jumping at doing research because you don't have that instant gratification as you would if you were doing a clinical trial for athlete's foot, which is only a 6-week-long trial.
Toenail treatment trials have to last for at least a year, and that makes them costly. But there is no shortage of pseudoscience and old wives' tales, which Liz found when researching online.
Bleach, hydrogen peroxide. What I mostly use is tea tree oil or lavender oil.
This makes Tracy Vlahovic's life difficult at times.
Oh, don't get me started. If I had a dollar for everything I've heard, I'd be a millionaire at this point. It's not just about applying something to the nail. It has to be something that will get through the nail plate and into the nail bed where the infection is. So it doesn't matter what you use. It has to be able to penetrate.
In addition to the questionable treatments in your kitchen and bathroom cabinets, you can also choose from a slew of over-the-counter products that promise to cure your toenail fungus. Vlahovic and I took a trip to the drugstore to check out the offerings in the foot care aisle. About 10 products there featured terrifying before and after pictures of diseased nails, and Vlahovic picked up one that promised a cure through grapeseed extract.
You know, basically it's water, ethanoic acid, xanthan gum, and fragrance. So I'm not really sure how effective it could be.
And it costs?
$23.99.
Wow.
All right, so let's look at ProClear's. This is ProClear's Fungal Shield. And let's see what's in this. Tolnaphdate. Tolnaphdate 1%. Tolnaphdate, it's basically for athlete's foot. It doesn't say anything on the back about using this for a toenail. So it says Fungal Shield. It has a picture with a nail. But it says on the skin around, adjacent to, and under nails, but doesn't say you can actually use it on the nail. I truly believe Tolnaphdate is too large of a molecule to really penetrate through the nail plate. So again, this is garbage.
Garbage is the verdict for the rest of the products, which all cost well over $10 for a small bottle. So is this story just a total bummer for toenail fungus sufferers like poor Liz?
I'm just so over it.
No, says Tracy Vlahovic. In fact, the FDA has just approved a new topical treatment for toenail fungus. The brand name is Jublia. It's expected to hit sales of $800 million in the U.S., and another product will come out shortly.
It's a class of antifungals we're all familiar with in the medical world, but it's never been used as a topical before. So certainly, again, the data there is very nice. It's beautiful. And I think patients will really like the further topical options that are coming out.
These new topicals seem to be stronger, more efficient, and they also work under nail polish. Vlahovic says there's currently a lot of movement in this field, which had been stagnant for some time, but even with better treatments, patients have to accept one bitter truth. There is no quick fix for this.
Nothing is going to work within a week, and nothing is going to work within a month. You must give things time.
So if anybody or any product promises you to cure this thing quickly, just don't buy it. We've posted some more advice on avoiding fungus, treatment options, and safe salons on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Two retirees from the Pennsylvania Department of Health say its employees were silenced on issues around Marcellus shale drilling. We're joined now by State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Collinari, who reported this story. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Mikan.
Katie, what did you learn about how the Department of Health was handling complaints related to natural gas drilling?
I spoke to two former employees, a community health nurse named Tammy Stuck and a program specialist with the Bureau of Epidemiology named Marshall Deasy. And both of them said that field staff who work at the state health centers or in one of the six district offices for the department were told not to return calls from residents who expressed health concerns about natural gas development. The nurse said that she received a list of about 15 to 20 buzzwords and phrases like drilling, gas, fracking. And if the caller mentioned one of those words, she was to take their name, take their number, and whatever the complaint was, and pass that information on to a supervisor. And supposedly someone else would call them back. She never found out what happened to those calls.
How would she typically handle a complaint call like that?
Normally, she said that she would talk to the patient about their symptoms, ask if they had seen a doctor, or see if there was any type of other services that were within the department that she could link them to, a clinic or something like that. Every once in a while, they would also get talking points from sort of the higher level folks at the Department of Health about particular issues. And they were generally left to their own devices.
So what does the Department of Health say about these allegations that nurses were asked not to return calls about impact of gas drilling? What do they say happened to those complaints?
The Department of Health said that that is absolutely not the policy, that they take these complaints very seriously, and that all of them get channeled to the Bureau of Epidemiology, where some employees are maintaining a database of all the calls that come in and following up on them, doing investigations. Spokesperson Amy Tizarsik has said that the department has received about 51 complaints since they started tracking them in 2011. And from their investigations, they found no link between illness and drilling.
Katie, what do we know about the health impact of drilling and how are other states handling this issue?
When you talk to doctors who are researching this or doctors who've actually seen patients who live near natural gas development, they describe patients who come to them with symptoms like nausea, nosebleeds, vomiting, lesions and skin rashes, and other ailments like that. And they come to them and usually say that, you know, I never had any of these symptoms until, you know, they started drilling about a mile away from me or until they built that compressor station. And it's actually very difficult for these doctors to get some answers. And none of them actually say that they've seen a direct link, but what they've noticed is sort of this cause and effect. Before the drilling, no health problems. After the drilling, these strange, possibly environmental exposures. And other states are actually taking notice of this. The state of New York has actually put large-scale hydraulic fracturing on hold until the Cuomo administration finishes doing an environmental and public health review of all the literature that's out there and all the studies that are out there right now. The state of Maryland is actually funding a study that's being done by the University of Maryland into what the potential health impacts would be of drilling in the western part of the state. But in Pennsylvania, Dr. Bernard Goldstein, who's the former dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, has actually been quite an outspoken critic of the Corbett administration. He says the administration missed an opportunity when Act 13 was passed, that's the state's two-year-old oil and gas law, to not give some funding to do some kind of a study or to create a health registry that would monitor patients over time living in these drilling areas.
I think notable, the Marcellus Shale bill that we have, our Act 13, provides an impact fee. $200 million a year, roughly, comes from that impact fee. It gets divided among 17 state agencies, sub-agencies, the Fish and Boat Commission. Not one penny goes to the Department of Health. The only way that you would not give a penny to the Department of Health from the impact fee is if you were absolutely certain that there was no health effects of the Marcellus Shale drilling.
And Dr. Goldstein also shared a story with us that, this policy with not returning calls, and it kind of went beyond that. He actually experienced this for himself. He was snuck into a meeting with about 100 employees with the department for the Bureau of Epidemiology to talk about shale gas drilling. The person who invited him actually said that, he needed to retitle his presentation to not include shale gas so that the political leadership in the department wouldn't know about it, because essentially employees were really not allowed to attend meetings where fracking or drilling would be on the agenda.
What could be the reason? I mean, the department says this is not happening, but the employees say it is happening. What could be the possible reason for the department to stifle conversations about the impact of drilling?
Well, I mean, it's a really controversial topic, Mike. And frankly, the state hasn't been given any resources to study this. It's not, critics like Dr. Goldstein say that it's really not a priority for the administration to pause and take a look at what the potential health impacts are. The two former employees that I talked to said that they're worried that it's going to have a lasting impact on public health, and that, by keeping it from being something that's an open conversation, even among employees in the Department of Health, kind of keeps it from being an open priority with the public.
Now, you said there is a person who is handling complaints from people. Have you spoken to that person?
I tried to reach the person who I knew was maintaining the database. He actually retired from the department last week, and he hung up on me.
Katie Collinari, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mikan.
Katie Collinari is a reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania. Coming up on The Pulse, when kids do serious scientific research, the approach is slightly different.
Things like Cool Ranch Doritos and Monster and Cheese Puffs and what was the last one? It was Diet Pepsi. And we saw, if we introduced those things, how they could stop or alter the development of fruit flies.
Stay tuned to The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
We're back with The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Cancer researchers often use fruit flies to study the disease, for example, altering the fly's genetics to learn how to combat cancer cells. Scientists at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia have been on the forefront of this approach, and now they've expanded their team of researchers to include one very unlikely group,
students at a resource-strapped Philadelphia public school. Kevin McQuarrie reports.
South Philly's Ibrahim Bakri is a matchmaking pro. During his senior year at the Academy at Palumbo, he learned that mating is simple. Get a bunch of girls together with a few guys in a small space, and the results are libidinously wild.
So we just put them in vials, a whole bunch of females, a couple males, and just left them overnight. And by the time we came back, there were eggs all over the place.
We're talking, of course, not of hormonal teenagers, but instead of fruit flies. Bakri's AP biology class is the first to take part in Fox Chase Cancer Center's Fruit Fly Footlocker program. Fox Chase provides a footlocker of top-notch gear to a high school science classroom, and students perform completely novel research that aims to determine how household food items affect fruit fly cell proliferation.
Things like Cool Ranch Doritos and Monster and Cheese Puffs and what was the last one?
Diet Pepsi.
And we saw, like, if we introduced those things, how they could stop or alter the development of fruit flies.
Bakri peers through a microscope that's attached to a 20-inch monitor that allows the rest of the class to see what he sees. The fruit fly eggs resemble small, reddish-brown periods. Some of the newly spawned flies crawl around on a purplish, jello-y goo called agar that, in this case, has been infused with traces of an energy drink.
My group had the Monster. It caused the population to grow exponentially.
The theory is that conducting these experiments on flies could help scientists better understand how diet can slow or speed cancer cell growth in humans.
So cancer cells are normal cells that just keep growing and growing uncontrollably and form tumors.
Chris Eichel is Palumbo's AP bio teacher.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to find some type of nutrient that prevents the cell from going through its normal cycle and kind of shuts off. So if we can find that, then the potential is you can actually stop cancer cells from growing.
Eichel helped develop the Footlocker program after taking a course at Fox Chase and then successfully petitioning the Philadelphia Ed Fund to finance the project via a $1,000 microgrant from Dow. To him, the really cool thing about this program is that it's not just play science. The kids' findings will actually go back to Fox Chase, where they'll be checked and compiled along with the center's larger body of research.
When you ask high school students, what do you want to be when you grow up? They mostly say, oh, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a nurse. Nobody ever says they want to be a researcher working in a lab. But it's the researchers who are doing all the important things.
It is. It's warm. It's full of fruit flies.
So what am I seeing here?
So we have incubators in the...
Whoa.
Has its own special aroma.
At Fox Chase, Dr. Alana O'Reilly opens the door to a fruit fly incubator, a refrigerator-looking chest that keeps the flies at ideal mating and egg-laying temperature. Special is one way to describe the smell of incubating flies.
It's a mixture of molasses, yeast, paint thinner, and it makes that very engaging.
Pungent.
Feels like home kind of smell.
For you.
Yes, for you, yeah.
In addition to running her own fruit fly research lab, O'Reilly oversees Fox Chase's teaching lab, which hatched the Footlocker program. It's all part, she says, of finding the next generation of scientists who will help advance the fight against cancer.
And what we've learned is that especially students from underprivileged areas tend not to go into science because it's so much work and so hard and there's really no support.
O'Reilly and her team have been very impressed with what's happened at Palumbo. Dara Ruiz Whalen, the lead instructor at the teaching lab, couldn't believe the response she received at the school's career day.
You're hoping one kid is going to get excited. And during career day, we had students that are like, is this really what you do? You get to do this? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, I want to do this. I want to figure this out. I want to cure cancer. And it's a big statement for a 16-year-old to make, but that's... Hey, you know what? If you can get a 16-year-old to say, I'm going to cure cancer. Okay, great. Let's see what we can do to help you get there.
Back at Palumbo, students scrambled to put together their end-of-year PowerPoint presentations of their research.
If you go to the data chart, it actually shows that in every case that there were more abnormal flies.
Like in all Philly public schools this year, students there have felt the effect of budget cuts that have slashed school resources to bare-bones levels. This program is but one example of how private philanthropy has attempted to band-aid over the district's larger fiscal constraints. Ibrahim Bakri is just grateful to have had the opportunity.
I think that, you know, we're trying to succeed in spite of what's happening around us, and I think we will, because
we've been exposed to things that are a little bit bigger than ourselves and exposed to things that we never would have thought of.
For The Pulse, I'm Kevin McCory.
And we've got some great photos of the students at work in their lab. Check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And this disclaimer, Fox Chase Cancer Center underwrites programming on WHYY. Nearly one in five inmates entering Pennsylvania prisons has tested positive for hepatitis C. That's according to a new study out this month in the American Journal of Public Health. And as Alana Gordon reports, the rates are even higher for women entering prison.
More than 100,000 inmates entering Pennsylvania prisons over several years were screened, and 18% came up positive for hepatitis C. 30% of female inmates had it. Outside prison, less than 2% of the general population has the virus. Brown University researcher Sarah Larney has some theories why women tested positive more often.
And that's related to the fact that women are more likely to have a history of injecting drug use and other indicators of poor health than men in prison.
Hepatitis C is often referred to as the silent epidemic. Symptoms may not appear for years. Untreated, it can lead to liver disease and cancer. It's the most common bloodborne virus in the U.S., and today is mainly spread through sharing needles. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now recommends anyone born between 1945 and 1966 get tested. Dr. Nicholas Scharf is the recently retired medical director for the Pennsylvania prison system. He says this new study shows why every inmate should be tested.
In the first place, if you restricted testing just to baby boomers, you would miss more than half of the cases in Pennsylvania.
Scharf says the prevalence of hepatitis C among new inmates in Pennsylvania has actually gone down, similar to general population trends, though that's not the case for female inmates. Most states only test inmates who identify as being high risk. Larney says Pennsylvania, on the other hand, is one of about a dozen states that screens everyone unless they opt out.
So a really important message from this study is that we can find a very large number of people with hepatitis C if we conduct universal screening in prisons. And then we have a really good opportunity to make an impact on the general public health by helping those people to stay healthy and to get treatment.
The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections reported treating 60 inmates for hepatitis C last year, costing a total of $1.5 million. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Lyme disease is a topic that's really getting under people's skin these days, with controversy raging over diagnosing and treating this debilitating illness. A new investigative report out this week suggests that many Lyme disease tests may not be accurate. The tests in question are FDA-exempt alternative tests that many people seek out to get answers for their Lyme-like symptoms. One of the labs conducting these tests is based right outside Philadelphia. Joining us now is the author of this article, Beth Daly, from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Beth, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Beth, can we start by distinguishing between the federally recommended tests for Lyme disease and the alternative tests?
So there's a big difference. The federally recommended tests, it's been vetted. It's been looked at by independent scientists and to make sure that the test accurately is diagnosing the number of people they say they are and also screening out people who don't have the disease. The other tests, which claim to have a better accuracy rate, may, but you don't really know because they haven't been sort of independently reviewed by any scientist or peer-reviewed journal. It's really people have to take the lab's word that the test works.
Usually tests are federally regulated. Why not for Lyme?
Well, that's a really good question. And it turns out a lot of tests are not federally regulated. Back in the 1970s, when the Food and Drug Administration began regulating diagnostic tests, They exempted what was then a really small group of tests. These are, if you can think about it, basically tests that were done in hospitals. They were like maybe variations on very common tests or sort of low risk. In recent years, a lot of companies have sort of used this exemption to basically market tests, diagnostic tests, to the public through doctors that have not been validated in any way. They don't have to prove to the FDA the test does what it says it does. Some of them do publish peer-reviewed literature to have independent reviews, but not all do. So at the end of the day, it becomes really, really difficult for a doctor or a patient to distinguish good tests from bad tests.
If a person thinks they have Lyme disease and they go to their doctor, how do they end up getting one of these alternative tests as opposed to the federally regulated and recommended tests?
Right. So this sort of bleeds into a much bigger controversy about Lyme disease that many of your listeners will probably be familiar with, which is there's extraordinary controversy over three aspects of Lyme disease. One, its diagnosis. Two, its treatment. And third, how long the illness can last. Every year, there's 3.4 million Lyme tests that go on that are federally recommended. So most mainstream doctors will send your blood away and have this Lyme test, and it will come back. The problem is it's not perfect. The federally recommended test early on in the disease will not diagnose you with Lyme if you just got it. That's because your body has to produce enough antibodies for the test to detect. And so if you just got bit by a tick and your body hasn't produced enough of these antibodies, you're going to probably test negative. Later on, the test becomes very accurate. So after a week or two, you know, if you have Lyme disease, it'll pop up. But that problem has really fueled a lot of the debate from the Lyme community who feel like the FDA tests are very inaccurate. And many people land in this very parallel medical world to the medical establishment where doctors call themselves Lyme literate, where they will diagnose you simply by looking at you or by using one of these tests. But the problem is there's no real validity or really peer review process behind that. So you're really just trusting their word when the doctors tell you of Lyme or trusting a test that hasn't been gone through the proper scientific review.
But the proponents of those tests will say, well, our tests pick up more Lyme. They pick it up when it's perhaps chronic or when it's early or when the levels are low.
Right. And they may, but I think most people would understand that you want to be sure that they're saying that, right? I could go in my outside my house and hang a shingle and say, I'm going to have a Lyme test and I'm going to have the best Lyme test in the world. But unless someone is independently reviewing that and saying that, yes, hey, I tried what you tried and I got the same results, I believe your test is right. Really, patients and doctors are just trusting that lab's word. There's one lab outside Philadelphia I've been looking at for a couple of years now, called Advanced Laboratory Services, that regulators and scientists have raised serious concerns about. The lab had promised validated results from an independent third party by this past April, and they've not yet delivered it. That raises questions, right? Like, they haven't yet proven their test works, yet they're selling it every single day to patients who are paying for it out of their own pocket.
Do we know how many patients are getting these non-proven Lyme tests?
So one of the most popular labs I talked to in California said they have about 25,000 tests a year. Advanced Laboratory Services told me last year they have about 4,000 tests, but now they're down to only about 50 a week.
Let's talk about costs. How much are people paying for the federally recommended tests, and what about the unregulated tests?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the cost comparisons are fairly similar. For the FDA tests, you know, can start out at $127 and go up to maybe $400 or more for more complicated tests. For unregulated tests, it can, you know, probably start around $100 for the very cheap ones, but it can go up to $1,000 very quickly. The difference is, though, is the patient paying for it themselves? In a lot of the federally recommended tests, it's covered by insurance for the most part, but many insurers, if not most, do not reimburse for these alternative Lyme tests. So the patient has to pay out of pocket for them.
What has to happen next for these tests to be standardized in some way and for patients to get answers?
Yeah, so the issue is bigger than Lyme. It goes for many, many diagnostic tests. But I think most people would agree that there needs to be standards for diagnostic tests. You can't have people making claims and selling tests that have not proven they work yet. I mean, that seems sort of basic, I think, to most members of the public. The problem is there's not a lot of effort to standardize those tests. Companies really are just either they really want to help patients in trying novel tests and selling them to the public, or they're just trying to make a dollar, some of them perhaps, but there's no real impetus by them to get standardized.
But Beth, it does seem like there is a demand for these tests because on some level, being diagnosed with Lyme disease offers an answer. When you have a whole lot of different symptoms and you're just not feeling right, and it seems like sometimes patients want that answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's interesting, right? Patients are very desperate. They're sick. They know they're sick, but they have not been told by the medical establishment what they have, so they look for answers elsewhere. And sometimes they get better from these alternative treatments, and that's good. So it's not such a clear answer like you should only believe the medical establishment and not others. It's an individual decision, not so much for the test, but basically how you want to proceed in getting diagnosed and trying treatment to get better at something.
Beth Daly is with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and has just written about tests for Lyme disease. Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, too.
Beth Daly did reach out to Advanced Laboratory Services, one of the labs producing these tests, and she received a response from the company's spokeswoman saying that validation studies were delayed but would still be conducted. Coming up on The Pulse, dealing with the shortage of an essential medical supply.
So I called up a clinical person, you know, that I knew at 11:30 at night and said, well, what happens if we were to run out of saline? Because I was really afraid about what might happen. And they were just like, yeah, it gets ugly fast.
That's still to come. You're listening to The Pulse on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Hospitals across the country are struggling with a shortage of one of their most essential medical supplies. Manufacturers are rationing saline, a product used all over the hospital to clean wounds, mix medications, or treat dehydration. Now, drug companies say they won't be able to catch up with demand until next year. From member station KQED in San Francisco, reporter April Demboski explains why something as basic as salt water is so hard to come by.
Reed Kennedy walks through the basement of San Francisco General Hospital. He's in charge of managing all the gloves and bandages and bedpans that pass through here to the ER and OR. Kennedy winds through shelves stacked with cardboard boxes and stops at a special back room with a combination lock.
IV solutions are under lock and key because they go in people's bodies, so we have to keep them under lock and key.
This is where the hospital keeps its precious saline supply. Kennedy calls it the secret squirrel chamber.
Saline is huge, hugely popular. It's just used everywhere. It's used in wound management. It's used in medication delivery. It's used in hydration. It's used just everywhere.
The patients upstairs wouldn't know it, but Kennedy is dealing with a serious shortage of saline. He first got a call last year from his vendor telling him they might not be able to deliver his full order.
We were just put on notice that it was going to be tight.
Then things got worse in January when the flu season hit. Saline bags flew off the shelves to rehydrate patients. Demand far outstripped supply.
Knocked us out.
But we're talking about salty water here. Can't drug companies just whip up some more?
To make one of these drugs is very complex, even though the drug itself is very simple.
That's Valerie Jensen, the director of the drug shortage program at the FDA.
And it takes about 3 weeks to make one batch of normal saline from start to finish.
She says the key challenge is making sure saline products are sterile. If you swallow a pill with a little bit of dirt on it, you'll be fine. But if a nurse injects saline into your vein that's even a little bit contaminated, you have a big problem. Jensen says FDA inspectors have found some nasty things in a range of IV drugs.
Bacteria or mold, glass particles in the vials.
That's why the FDA sets strict quality standards for the facilities that manufacture saline and other IV drugs. But the agency has to find a delicate balance between safety and supply. Scott Crandall is with Novation, a group buyer in Texas that manages saline contracts for SF General and 2,000 other hospitals. He's been hearing from manufacturers that increased FDA scrutiny is interfering with drug production.
During last year, all of the suppliers had issues within their facilities where they had to correct certain things the FDA found.
But some of those things were serious. Hospira, one manufacturer of saline, issued a recall earlier this year because of leaks in its saline bags. Before that, Baxter found particles in its saline and had to recall four lots. Crandall says the company had to shut down its plant for weeks for maintenance.
Slowed their production down 10-20% are the numbers we're being told.
Winter weather was a factor, too. Satellite Healthcare Procurement Director Colin Carthen says Baxter told him that snow and ice storms in the Midwest were delaying trucks headed for California.
As the weather got worse, we began to see more and more backorder issues.
Carthen oversees the saline supply for 70 dialysis centers across California and the U.S., including this one in San Leandro. Each patient needs 4 liters a week to clean their blood during treatment. At the worst of the shortage, Carthen realized the health of 6,000 patients was on him.
So I called up a clinical person, you know, that I knew at 11:30 at night and said, well, what happens if we were to run out of saline? Because I was really afraid about what might happen. And they were just like, yeah, it gets ugly fast.
Every day, Carthen says he spent hours juggling and rerouting supplies so everyone had enough. The FDA is trying to mitigate the shortage by importing saline from Spain and Norway. But FDA economist Marta Voshinska says that's not a sustainable solution, since those countries have to supply their own hospitals.
There is no spot market. You can't buy it like pork bellies or grains. It's not oil. You cannot go on a marketplace and order a certain amount.
Saline prices don't really fluctuate either. Hospitals are protected under contracts that keep rates locked through next year. But Novation saline buyer Scott Crandall says all bets are off when those contracts expire.
The suppliers have already signaled to the market that they plan on increasing price significantly. And when I say that, it could double and triple in some aspects.
That means paying $2 or $3 a bag instead of $1, and it all adds up. But it still could be cheaper than what it costs to work administrative wonders managing a dwindling supply. For The Pulse, I'm April Dymbosky.
We're going to stick with the topic of salt for a moment, this time salt in food. Philly health officials want us to cut the salt in our diets.
Nearly half of all African-American adults in Philly have high blood pressure, putting them at risk for stroke. Eating too much salt is part of the problem.
Salt is one of those perennial health villains up there with sugar and fat. So how important is this? And who needs to heed the warnings? We asked Tanya English to find out.
In some people, too much sodium makes the body hold on to excess fluid. That pushes up blood pressure and puts an extra burden on the heart. The thing is, lots of the food that Philly loves is full of salt. Just stop by one of the food trucks near Independence Hall.
Can you tell me what's on the hoagie?
Capicola, Genova salami, provolone cheese, and ham.
A typical hoagie, 12-inch hoagie, with all the usual fixins, so cold cuts, cheese, mayo, other things, that has more than a day's worth of salt.
Giridhar Mallya is Philadelphia's health policy director. He says most of the sodium we eat comes from food prepared by someone else.
Sweet peppers, what else?
No mustard, no ketchup, no.
Yellow mustard and a little ketchup.
We need folks in the city to know where their salt is coming from, whether it's a chef in a restaurant or whether it's a big food company that has processed and packaged something for you.
Last summer, a panel of scientists studied the links between salt and health and came up with no evidence, no benefits or harms to lower the current recommended daily dose.
The message that got sent, I think, to a lot of people was, oh, we can eat as much salt as we want and it'll be fine.
Malia says that's the wrong message, because most of us eat way more than the current recommended level, even if you don't eat hoagies or pizza or Chinese takeout.
The average American eats about 3,400 milligrams of salt per day.
That equals about 1.5 teaspoons, and that's a lot more than the 1,500 to 2,300 milligrams of sodium that federal officials suggest for good health. Of course, some people don't agree with federal health officials. Morton Satin speaks for the salt industry and is known online as the salt guru.
Legend has it, he was born from the sea, used a salt shaker as a baby rattle, and hated the taste of broccoli until it was sprinkled with those magic crystals.
He's a food scientist with the trade group, the Salt Institute. Consuming extremely high or low levels of salt is a problem for health. But beyond that, Satin says the science on salt is far from settled.
Some bland bureaucrats go ahead and select a couple of numbers, 1,500 to 2,300 milligrams sodium. It's not based on any physiological evidence.
He says consider the heart health and the long life of people who eat a Mediterranean diet. That way of eating includes lots more vegetables, salads, olive oil, but...
This is the little dirty secret of the Mediterranean diet that nobody's ever mentioned, that their salt content or the salt intake is almost 40% higher than the American salt intake.
It's a matter of balance, he says, not demonizing any one thing, be it sugar or fat or salt.
We don't eat a bag of nutrients. We eat foods.
Smell and taste researcher Gary Beecham says as humans, we evolved in an environment without much salt.
We ate mostly plants and fruit, and there wasn't much salt there, and we need sodium for our bodies, so we developed a special mechanism to detect it and to make it delicious.
Fast forward to modern times, and lots of our food is saturated with salt. A few years ago, Beecham was among scientists who recommended that the government change the rules and force food makers to reduce the salt that they put in food.
Hi, Chef Bob here at the Cook with Campbell Kitchen. On the menu today is low-sodium beef and barley soup, using our ready-to-use, no-salt-added beef broth.
There doesn't seem to be any plans to regulate salt, but the Food and Drug Administration may set some guidelines and ask all food companies to make some voluntary changes. Beecham says a gradual approach is best.
The idea of asking companies or restaurants to just cut the salt out is hopeless. They discovered that they can't advertise it because when people see the advertisement, low salt, they just immediately think, not going to taste good.
Salt balances out the bitterness of food and has lots of uses beyond taste. It can help preserve freshness, color, even the texture of food, which makes it even more valuable to food makers.
Compared to, say, even a few hundred years ago, salt is incredibly cheap. It's the cheapest ingredient they can put in food, with the exception perhaps of water.
So back to Philly. Who really needs to shake the salt habit? And who are health experts most worried about? Policy Director Giridhar Mallya says the city's campaign was especially designed to speak to people with high blood pressure, people at risk for stroke, and African Americans.
African Americans are more salt sensitive, meaning that even a half teaspoon more of salt per day can increase the blood pressure of African Americans on average by 6 to 9 points, whereas it might only be 3 to 6 points among Caucasians.
About 40% of blacks in the U.S. have high blood pressure, which is often a precursor to heart disease, kidney disease, and stroke. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Wait times at VA hospitals have made a lot of headlines lately.
The Department of Veterans Affairs is under fire over allegations that administrators in Phoenix kept a secret waiting list to hide delays in patient care.
Dallas veterans needing a primary care appointment have an average wait time of 60 days. In Houston, it's 44 days, and in Phoenix, it's 55.
A new VA audit found that new patients at McGuire had to wait an average of nearly 2 months and 2 weeks to see a primary care doctor.
In reality, they waited as long as 115 days.
Is it possible that in some cases, unrealistic expectations have created a situation where some staff is in fact cooking the books? I want to look at that.
The answer is not to allow bureaucrats to create fake waiting lists so that it looks better. The answer is to get in and fix the problem. And as much as I love General...
And a few minutes ago, Secretary Shinseki offered me his own resignation. With considerable regret, I accepted.
With that, President Obama today announced a major shakeup at the top of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs as that embattled office now grapples with how to clean up its troubled health care system.
New Jersey's Cooper University Healthcare wants to be part of the solution. Starting next month, they are guaranteeing same-day appointments with a primary care doctor for Southern New Jersey veterans. Cooper Hospital Chairman George Norcross says his organization wants to do right by veterans as Washington struggles to fix the VA.
We're just doing it. This is our program. We're not waiting for legislation. We're not waiting for transition. We're implementing something. It starts July 1st, and we're going to make it work.
Veteran Sam Podietz, who served from 1960 to 63, says access to a primary care doctor is really important, especially when you need advanced care.
You have to see a primary care doctor. You can't see a specialist unless you see a primary care doctor. I mean, you just can't pick up and walk into the VA and say, hey, I want to be taken care of.
Cooper Hospital officials say they have plenty of doctors to treat vets, and they are ready to absorb the cost if vets can't pay. The Cooper system has 100 clinics in South Jersey. The program is not available to veterans outside of that area. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English and Alana Gordon. Steve Trader contributed to the show. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joe Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, with your questions and ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you so much for listening.